Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Blogging Theology. Today, I'm delighted to talk again to Sheikh Hamza Karamali. You are most welcome, sir.
Thank you for having me again, Paul. It's a pleasure to be here.
For those who don't know, Hamza is the founder of Basira Education, where he trains parents, teachers, and scholars in high schools, weekend religious schools, and a variety of other educational institutions how to show their students why Islam is true. He's developed a textbook, an online teachers portal, and is on a mission to train 10,000 teachers. And I'll link to his work in the description below. Today, Sheikh Hamza will be speaking on something particularly interests me, and that is Ibn Sina's influence on traditional Islamic theology. So it seemed like a good place to begin. Who was Ibn Sina, and can you tell us a little bit more about him?
Yes. So Ibn Sina, his name is Hussein. His father's name was Abdullah, and his grandfather's name was Ibn Sina. So he's Hussein, the son of Abdullah, the son of Sina. He was a Persian Muslim born in present-day Uzbekistan in the end of the 10th century. So he lived about two generations after the peak of the translation movement. From Greek philosophy into the Arabic language and Greek medicine into the Arabic language in the Abbasid age. So he's a philosopher. He was primarily a philosopher. He wasn't an Islamic scholar, but he was a philosopher. He wrote and studied in Arabic. The early translators, they worked with the Greek texts. They studied them. They commented on them. They translated them into Arabic. Ibn Sina, he comes a little bit later, and this is a good thing, and it influences the way that he did philosophy. He drew primarily on Al-Farabi, who's an other important Muslim philosopher. He lived a generation before Ibn Sina. He was very influential, both in the East and also the West, like Ibn Sina, who's known as Avicenna in Christian Europe, in Latin. So Ibn Sina memorized the Quran when he was 10 years old. He studied logic as a child. He began reading Greek philosophy his own, and he studied Ibn Sina. He learned from him. And it said, he relates that he mastered medicine. Medicine then was a philosophical pursuit. Galen. He was successful in treating the local sultan, and because of which the sultan, he gave him access to a library. He studied, he read voraciously. He began writing when he was 21 years old. He was a genius. And I think that his most prominent works are two books, although he wrote over 200 works on all kinds of philosophical, scientific, astronomical, medical topics, music. He wrote music. He was a poet. But his most important books are, there's a book in medicine called Al-Qanun fi Tibb, which the canon of medicine, which was it's considered the most important, influential medical textbook all over the world in Europe. It was taught in Europe in Latin translation until just a couple of hundred years ago. He was known for his medicine. So Islamic, there's this thing called Islamic medicine, hikmah medicine in the Indian subcontinent. There are people called hakims. And this is caught on in the alternative medicine community. That hikmah medicine is Yunani medicine, Greek medicine, and it's still has its Avicennan roots, which goes back to Galen. So he was important in the field of medicine. This is a really important book that he wrote. I think the other really important book, which is what our conversation today will focus on, is called Kitab al-Shifa. It's a four-volume work. And he took the philosophy of the time. So I think it's important for us to understand what philosophy then is. Philosophy then is basically Aristotle, right, maybe some Plato. And what that represents is what the modern university represents today. So Aristotle, his works were compiled by his students, and he wrote on everything. He wrote on logic, he wrote on ethics, he wrote on politics, he wrote on theology. And so he has a corpus called the Organon, and it became the centerpiece of human knowledge. And
Aristotle. Aristotle was a Greek, what we would call today a Greek man. He lived, what, 5 centuries BC before Christ. And he knew Plato, another amazing philosopher, and Socrates, who, of course, wrote very little, if anything. But those three were all together, literally knew each other. They taught each other 500 BC. So we're talking about some seriously old, you know, ancient figures who were directly influential in Europe, but also on Ibn Sina himself. So I just want to clarify who Aristotle was. And he's still a very important figure today, actually, in philosophy and political theory. But anyway, that's a different subject.
Sorry. Right. Yeah, and so his learning was the learning. So if you want to learn anything, you went to Aristotle. There are people who developed his work, something called Neoplatonism. It tried to merge his thought with Plato. And there was work done within his system. And Ibn Sina, that's what he was studying. So what he was studying when he was self-taught and he studied all of these things, it would be the equivalent of somebody today picking up, reading all of the textbooks of political science and logic and philosophy and medicine and mathematics and just kind of teaching yourself and then deciding to write.
He didn't seek out these ancient philosophers. These were the standard curricula of the day in his university life. So that's why he was interacting with them rather than any other people, perhaps.
Exactly. And so he studied it all, and then he wrote his own summary with his own Islamic flavor. So it's in Arabic. He inserts some Quranic words and Quranic concepts into it. And his book is called Kitab al-Shifa. He wrote The Healing. And he wrote other books as well, but this is it summarizes everything. His works were, he was Robert Wisnowski. He has an important book called Avicenna's Metaphysics in Context. And he considers Ibn Sina to be the end point of this Aristotelian Platonic philosophy. And he made the most original contributions after. He said that the reason why he did that was because he wrote in Arabic and he was self-taught and he didn't feel obliged to adhere to any kind of conventions. And then his works were later translated into Latin. Thomas Aquinas was influenced by him, cites him by name, others as well. Yep. So that's Ibn Sina.
Yeah, so he's a clear polymath, as we would call him. He was a master in multiple fields, expert in many, many fields, which is very rare, if ever happens today, because of increased specialization. But he's also really perhaps much more influential in Europe in many ways, but for his medical expertise. And as you said, his medical textbook was used in Europe as the standard go-to text for medical practitioners for centuries until just several centuries ago. So that's remarkable cross interconnectedness of the Islamic and Christian civilizations going over many centuries. But how did Ibn Sina's Islamic beliefs influence the way he did philosophy? That would be my next question.
So, he's known for something called the essence-existence distinction, which he introduced. And I'll explain it in the context of his argument for the existence of God, and which is the main focus of today's conversation. If we go back to Aristotle, Aristotle had an argument for the existence of something like a God. Aristotle, his argument is the argument from motion. He argued for the existence of a prime mover. The goal of Aristotle was to explain the changes that we perceive in the universe. So motion, movement, and change for him are the same thing. And he explained the changes on Earth through the changes in the heavenly spheres. He said that the stars, they're embedded into these concentric spheres that are clear, and those spheres move, and that's how we see the movements of the stars at night. Has like astrological, you know, significance, and things came out of that. But he's saying that it's these movements of these heavenly things that influence the movements and change on Earth. And he argued that the movements of these heavenly bodies, they needed to be based on something else that wasn't moving. Wow. And so there's an unmoved mover. So,
hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Aristotle's argument for the existence of God, it uses the language of potentiality and actuality. So he says that if the heavens are moving, or if anything else is moving, it's potentially before it's changing. So a seed becomes a tree. So when you have a seed, it's going to become a tree. It's going to move into becoming a tree. So the seed is potentially a tree. And so it has this potentiality, and then it's actualized into being a tree. So he says that in order to move from potentiality to actuality, there needs to be something that moves it. And that thing itself can't move from potentiality to actuality. It has to be pure actuality, unmoved mover. And that's his godlike being. So that's how he expressed his argument for the existence of something that's like a god. Ibn Sina, when he didn't make the prime mover argument. He made the contingency argument. So if you in the Shifa, in his book of philosophy, the way that it begins, he starts by looking at the things that exist. And then he divides the things that exist into either those that exist necessarily or those that exist contingently. So he introduces these terms. Mm. You can trace the existence of these terms back to people who came before him. Some people trace them back to Aristotle, but they're given a new significance in Ibn Sina. And his argument for the existence of God is that the universe is contingent. It needs something, and he doesn't use potentiality and actuality, and it depends on a necessary being. Mm-hmm. So when he describes the contingency or necessity of things, then he's describing their natures, their essences, and then he's asking the question of whether or not things that have certain natures, they exist. So he introduces this idea of essence, this idea of existence. And so in his philosophy, and in philosophy ever since, there's people, they argue about what it means for something to exist, mm. what kinds of existence are there, what does it mean for something to be an essence, what kind of essences are there. So and this has its, so Ibn Sina was not a scholar, he's not a religious scholar, but he was a Muslim. And he's a Muslim philosopher. He memorized the Quran. And he lives in a Muslim land. So he's influenced by his beliefs in God. And he's an independent thinker. And his God is is someone who's a necessary being. And so it comes in this way into his metaphysics, into his theology.
Hmm. Okay, so I mean, he's hailed as a great Islamic philosopher, but at the same time, it seems like he wasn't Islamic enough for many Sunni theologians. This is where we get into interesting territory now. So why was that? What's that about?
So there was a scholar by the name of Ghazali. Imam Ghazali is my favorite scholar of all time. I'll talk about him sometime. But he wrote many books. One of his books is called Tahafut al-Falasifa, means the incoherence of the philosophers.
Right. And guess what? I'm going to hold it up, but you're going to do this. You've got the same copy, haven't you, I think?
Yeah, I do.
Al-Ghazali's The Incoherence of Philosophy. It's quite a big, fat tome. And it just says on the inside cover, The Incoherence of the Philosophers, this book by Al-Ghazali, ranks amongst the most important works of one of the most fascinating thinkers in the history of Islam. So this is a monumental work, not to be sniffed at. There we go. There's my copy.
Yeah, that's an excellent edition. It has the English and the Arabic.
Yes.
So Ghazali, the introduction to this book is really fascinating. It shows. So the incoherence is actually it's a philosophical work. So sometimes people they say that Ghazali he finished off philosophy or something. But that's not what he's doing, because when he's talking about the incoherence of the philosophers, he's showing, and the philosophers, his two primary philosophers that he's treating are Al-Farabi and Ibn Sina. He mentions that in his introduction. So he when he's saying they're being incoherent, he's saying that they're actually philosophically inconsistent. Mm-hmm. So Ghazali, he says that the educated masses of in his time, philosophically educated masses in his time, they are enamored by the works of the ancients because they make logical arguments. They talk about all of these topics that religious scholars aren't talking about, and they talk about the universe and the celestial spheres, and so people they read. They're impressed by what they read. And because they're impressed, they just accept it all wholesale, uncritically. So he says that they're not being critical. And so his goal here is to show that they are philosophically incoherent on certain areas. And he says on many areas, they're not philosophically incoherent. They're perfectly okay. And he mentions mathematics is there's nothing wrong with that field. So he's willing to accept them where they're right and philosophically engage them where they become, where they're incorrect. And so this book, The Incoherence, is it's really important in Islamic intellectual history. So he critiques Ibn Sina, because Ibn Sina was not a scholar. Ghazali was a scholar, meaning that he studied Islamic law, he studied the Quran, he studied the Sunnah. He was the leading professor, the head professor of the Nizamiya Madrasa in his time in a major Islamic city. People used to come and graduate from him. And so he is a religious scholar, and he is evaluating the works of Ibn Sina, which is becoming increasingly influential. And he notes that Ibn Sina, he reaches conclusions on certain positions that go against what the Quran says. And so he wants to say that this goes against the Quran, but he doesn't just want to say it goes against the Quran, don't believe it, burn the books, don't read it. He wants to say that it goes against the Quran. Let's engage it rationally and see whether or not it's correct. And so he outlines a number of errors that Ibn Sina makes, and he gives philosophical arguments for them. And many of them, they prefigure modern science. And because Aristotle, he made a number of scientific mistakes that hindered the progress of science, Galileo and everything else. The things that Ghazali does, it removes many of those obstacles. That's a topic for another time. But so he does that. And then on three counts, he says that Ibn Sina's conclusions are actually very serious. And he said that this constitutes somebody who holds these positions would no longer be a Muslim if they hold those positions. And those three positions are the denial of the bodily resurrection, and the fact that God doesn't know the details of things. So Aristotle's God and Ibn Sina's God doesn't know in detail what's happening, just has like a a general conception. And the third thing is the fact the eternity of the universe. The universe did not begin exist. It wasn't created ex nihilo. So he gave philosophical explanations.
Those three beliefs that Ibn Sina held clearly contradict the teaching of the Quran. The Quran does teach the universe or the earth had a beginning. It was created clearly. Yeah. It does teach the resurrection of the dead, obviously. And of course, it does know particulars because it says in one place, you know, that God knows, you know, a leaf falling in a dark place.
Exactly.
He knows atoms. So I've always found it odd that Ibn Sina denied those when he, as you say, he knew the Quran by heart and that he would have known what the Quran teaches. And yet he insisted, nevertheless, that he knew better than the Quran, it seems. It seems paradoxical to me.
Yeah. He used his mind. He says, I disagree with this. And so he made arguments for why he disagreed with it.
So how would you respond to the claim that despite the fact that Al-Ghazali and the later Asharites who followed him were at serious odds with Ibn Sina, perhaps even not considering him to be Muslim? And by the way, I'd like you to address the question, did Al-Ghazali actually takfir Ibn Sina? Because it sounds like he did, but maybe he didn't. And yet they actually took some of their most important arguments, such as the argument from contingency from Ibn Sina. So there's two questions there. One is, did Al-Ghazali takfir him, in fact, because he could have done? And secondly, why did he take arguments from him? Because he was, you know, so wrong on some points.
So Ghazali lived after Ibn Sina. Ibn Sina is long gone. Ibn Sina isn't alive when Ghazali is writing.
Right.
So he is, but there's other people who are holding his ideas and propagating them, and the source is Ibn Sina. So Al-Ghazali, he identifies the source and he talks about the ideas, and then he talks about the ideas. So use the word takfir. So what's takfir? Takfir is to say somebody is a kafir.
Yes.
So meaning a non-Muslim. So the way that we, unfortunately, we understand this is that it is a means of excluding somebody from the Muslim community, saying that I'm not going to talk to you, saying that, you know, just a social kind of ostracization. Right. But that's not what Ghazali is doing. What Ghazali is doing is he is answering a philosophical question. And that philosophical question is that I am a Muslim. I'm a Muslim. And as a Muslim, I believe that Muhammad is God's messenger. So when I, when believing that he's God's messenger means that if he tells me there's a resurrection, I believe it. If he tells me God knows everything, I believe it. If he tells me that the universe began to exist, I believe it. So I'm a Muslim and I want to believe in what the Prophet Muhammad said. So now this person is saying something and now there's disagreement over, there's many things that the Prophet Muhammad said that scholars disagree about. Hmm. And there's room for disagreement because many things that he said were not stated clearly. They haven't been transmitted with conclusive evidence. There's room to say that he probably, maybe he didn't say it, but there's some things that he said and taught that every Muslim knows. And so the classical example of this is that it's unlawful to drink wine, you know, or to eat pork. So this is something that Muslim children know this, and they know this from generation to generation, all the way back to the Prophet. So what this means is this mass knowledge, it means that there's a general transmission of something from the Prophet, practical transmission from generation to generation in such a clear way. It's like the azan that's given or fasting in Ramadan. Like it's just the social effects of belief in what the Prophet said that have been preserved by hundreds of thousands of people in every generation passed on. When you look at this from a philosophical perspective, historical perspective, it leaves you with absolute certainty that the Prophet Muhammad taught this.
Yeah.
So now, what that means is that if somebody says, I don't believe in this, then they are not believing in the Prophet Muhammad. And if it's important to somebody to believe in the Prophet Muhammad, this is a question that they have to ask. They have to ask that if I hold this position, does it constitute disbelief in the Prophet Muhammad or does it not? And the and Sunni scholars like Ghazali, they gave so much latitude. They said if there's any way in which somebody could theoretically say that the Prophet Muhammad didn't say this, then your iman, you're still considered a Muslim. But there's some things that, because of this social transmission en masse, it's just anybody with a mind who looks at it, you have to say that that if you're doing this, the Prophet Muhammad didn't, you're disbelieving in the Prophet. And so Ghazali, when he says that on these three points, what he's saying, he's not issuing an edict of social exclusion. Right. But he is answering a philosophical question that is important to a religious Muslim living at that time. And and he says that on these three counts, yes, to hold this belief. He doesn't say Ibn Sina is a kafir, burn him at the stake. You know, so he says that on these three points.
He's making a philosophical judgment then. He's not making a legal ruling on the status of someone, whether or not they're part of the community or not. He's making a philosophical judgment on what today we would call a very academic point, although a very substantial point about core matters of creed in a way. Well, what does the Quran say about the resurrection or the eternity of the universe or God knowing anything? You know, these are fundamental matters. Okay.
And, you know, I think it's very significant that, you know, we can pick up the incoherence today and not just the incoherence, we can read the Shifa. You know, the Shifa has also been translated. And Ibn Sina, despite Ghazali's judgment on his ideas, amongst Muslims, in the Muslim scholarly tradition, by the theologians, by the logicians, he's called al-Sheikh al-Ra'is, which means the chief sheikh, because he was really intelligent. He said a lot of good things. But where he was disagreed with, you engage him and you can still know what it is that he said. And if you study Islamic theology, one of the things that comes out is the intellectual openness and humility of the Muslim tradition, because we know what the Mu'tazilite said. We know what all of these sects, we know who the people were that said this, we know what they said, we know why they said it, and we study why they're wrong all the way to this day. And when I compare this, you know, to like the history of the West and Christianity, you know, there's this sect in the Balkans called the Bogomils. And the Bogomils, they were a dangerous heresy in Christian Europe. And the Catholic Church, you know, they posed a threat to the Catholic Church. And they converted in huge numbers to Islam. Many of the Bosnian Muslims, they go back to, they trace their roots to this sect. But nobody knows what they believed in. We know they existed, but their books are burned. They're prohibited. You can't read them. And so when you try to do the intellectual history of Christianity and what other sects have believed, it's a really difficult task. But our tradition is, you know, I think it's a testament to it's amazing.
I mean, you speak of the heresy hunting intolerance of the Christian world in contrast to the Muslim world and how they treated people like Ibn Sina. I mean, we still have his works. Well, one of the most famous examples of that historically is a man called Michael Servetus. You can Google him. He was in the 16th century. And he had the misfortune of having views. He was a Christian, but he had certain views of the Trinity, which were very radical for his day. He wasn't actually a Unitarian. He's often said he was, but technically he did believe Jesus was divine. But his understanding of the Trinity was very, very unorthodox. I'm not going to go into his views. But the point was that he was actually, he for some inexplicable reason, he went to Geneva, where the famous reformer John Calvin lived and worked. And he was detained and he was charged with multiple counts of heresy. And John Calvin, who today, interesting, John Calvin's a really important figure in the West. Yeah. If you're American evangelical, you will know about John Calvin. He is like the grandfather, the granddaddy of more American evangelicalism. And they call themselves Calvinists. So they looked at this guy as this great theologian. He wrote the Institutes of Christian Religion, this huge volume of systematic theology, which I've got here. And I mentioned him is because he publicly called for, as an official in Geneva, for the execution of Michael Servetus, as did everyone else in that day, other reformers, Martin Luther and others. And the poor guy, Michael Servetus, not only did he have his books burnt, which they were, he had himself burnt at the stake. In fact, he was put on the stake with his books and he was burnt to death. And he died in 1553. You compare and contrast the intolerance, the extreme intolerance of the Christian world and their leading people they look up to. Now, there's no dirt attached to John Calvin now in the Christian world that I'm aware of, even though he publicly called and ordered the execution of his fellow Christian in Geneva because they had a difference of opinion on the doctrine of the Trinity. So the contrast couldn't be more extreme between the extreme intolerance of the Christian West and the great tolerance of the Muslim world at that time. And this is not an isolated incident. These are typical of civilizational differences. These are very, very archetypal, paradigmatic differences between the two civilizations over centuries. And this is often not realized, but if you, as I say, just Google John Calvin or Michael Servetus, and you'll see all the historical details, horrific details of the way dissenters, religious dissenters, and the intolerance, how they were punished. Very hot. I mean, Michael Servetus, bless him, was burnt to the at the stake alive with his books. It staggers belief. And a Christian leader ordered this. They all ordered it. Lots of Christian leaders required and mandated this. Anyway, enough of. Just wanted to share that horrific story, which is actually very relevant to, I think, to your discussion. Thank you.
It means you're not secure in your belief. It means that when somebody raises a rational question, you feel threatened. It means that you don't have any argument. It means you can't rationally engage. It means the only thing, only option you have is persecution. And it says a lot, of things. So you also asked about so I think one more thing that I wanted to mention was that Ghazali actually, and the later Muslim theologians, they didn't take Ibn Sina's argument wholesale. And that's why the incoherence, Ghazali wrote the incoherence. So he had his argument, but although it was influenced by his Islamic beliefs, he preserved elements of Aristotle in that argument. And he preserved the fact that God does not have any volition. God doesn't choose to make the world the way that it is. It necessarily follows from him. The universe didn't begin to exist. He doesn't know things. So it's not actually just about contingency, but what is contingency? Contingency means that the world is needy. Now, the absolute neediness of the world, it's reflected in the Judeo-Christian Islamic belief that the universe did not exist. It was nothing. And it was created by God out of nothing. And God directly creates everything at every instant out of his free will. And he didn't have to make it that way. He could have made it differently. Yeah. And that's real contingency. So there was a lack of contingency in Ibn Sina's contingency argument that Ghazali then corrected, and that was the thing that later on took hold in the Islamic world.
Okay, but my next question is really: but didn't they take these Sunni theologians? Take it from Ibn Sina and then modify it to suit their purposes. I mean, doesn't that mean that they took from him? They borrowed teaching, they learned teaching, and that the central argument of the Muslim theologians is taken from someone who many of them thought made theological mistakes. And this makes it might seem paradoxical.
Well, I don't think that's the case. So it's kind of like... it's kind of like in our last conversation, we talked about the Quranic design argument. Mm. Right? So there's an intelligent design argument that's made by the Christian evangelicals. And this intelligent design argument for the existence of God marshals evidence from modern science, these wonderful photographs that you publish, no design. You just look at that. Oh my God. Like, how can anybody imagine that God doesn't exist? And so it's a great start to an argument. So if we as Muslims take this and then go back to our own religious commitments and add contingency to the mix, then we take their argument and we make it native to something that's already there in our books. But when we do that, what we're doing is we are engaging with the concerns of the time, we're using the language of the time, and our argument becomes more effective and it gains a language, an idiom that allows people to understand things in a way that they couldn't otherwise have understood. So it's in the same way with Ibn Sina. He believes in God. Like, there's lots of people who believe in God who aren't Muslim. He's engaged with something. He's done a good job. He's not quite there. And he's influenced by his own religious commitments. So if I, as a Muslim, Ghazali comes along and says, well, I believe in the contingency of the universe, there's verses of the Quran about it, Allahu Samad, and many other verses that depend on it. And now but what he's done is he's connected it to the scientific concerns of the time. He's using the language of the time. He's using the language of the modern day intelligentsia. And so if I just take it and tweak it and make it fit, then it becomes an excellent contemporary expression, an effective expression of what I believe. And so I haven't taken the idea from him, but I've used what he's done to better express what I already had before.
Yeah. No, that makes sense. So how exactly did Ibn Sina influence traditional Islamic theology, if at all?
So he had a huge influence, and this is why. So there's two things. So remember, Ibn Sina is a philosopher. Now, philosopher, the Arabic term for this is a faylusuf, falsafa. So falsafa, Ghazali, when he talked about it, and others, they described what the philosopher are doing. Ibn Sina himself describes it. The goal of the philosopher is, I want to discover everything that I possibly can using my mind. And I'm not going to use anything else. I'm not going to use a holy book. I'm not going to use revelation. I'm just going to use my mind and figure everything out. This is philosophy. So in this sense, the modern university is entirely philosophy, because when you do science, you do economics, you do any subject, you're just trying to figure things out with your mind. So there's this, it's this enterprise of using the mind to figure everything out. So Ibn Sina, that's what he's doing. Now, Ghazali says that, well, I'm a Muslim, and so I have the Quran as a source of knowledge. I have the Sunnah as a source of knowledge. I go to the Quran and I gain knowledge from it. What do I do? Traditional Islamic theology, it says that belief is divided into three categories: belief in God and his attributes, belief in prophets and messengers and their attributes, and then belief in the unseen and the afterlife, and how to, ethical behavior in this life and so on. So the first part, existence of God, the Quran actually teaches us to use our minds to see that God exists. And the Quran actually teaches us to use our minds to come to the inference that the Prophet is a genuine messenger. And when I do that, I see rationally that God exists and the Prophet is his messenger. I see, in other words, that Islam is true. That is the why Islam is true thing that you mentioned at the beginning that I work with. Yep. Then what happens is, now a door of knowledge opens up to me. Now I can pick up the Quran and I can say, I believe based on evidence that this is coming from God, because I know that Muhammad is God's messenger and he said this. Now I can use this to discover things that somebody could not discover using their mind alone. Right. I can discover resurrection. I can discover what's going to happen after I die. I can discover how God has commanded me to live in this life. I discover all kinds of things. So Ghazali is taking this, and then Ibn Sina has this rational system. And so the theologians, they said, why don't we take the rational system, which is the university knowledge of the day, and use that to do the first two parts of our theology, to prove that God exists and to prove that the prophet is God's messenger, and take it back to first principles and bring logic into it and bring science into it and just do the whole thing. And so we'll use Ibn Sina for that, because he has a good first cut system. So they take it and they transplant it, and they sift out all of the other pieces. And then at the end, they add a piece about the afterlife. Yeah. So the later theologians, like Taftazani, he wrote a book called Sharh al-Aqaid al-Nasafiyya, probably the most influential book of Sunni theology across the world, still studied to this day everywhere. He describes the development of traditional Islamic theology, Kalam, and he says that it went through various stages. And he said in the last stage, what happened was that it merged with falsafa so that it became indistinguishable from falsafa, except for this last part, which is like an appendage. And then what happens is that this is theology. It now becomes, this is one of the names for the science of Islamic theology, is the foundations of religion, Usul al-Din. Now, if you have this basis, now when you do tafsir of the Quran, explain a verse of the Quran, you're doing it on a rational foundation that this is the word of God. When you explain a hadith of the Prophet, you're doing it on a rational foundation that it's from the messenger of God. And so what it's done is it's taken all of our religious beliefs and integrated it seamlessly into the university knowledge of that time. And that's how Ibn Sina, that's how he influenced Islamic theology. And it's really, but now it's outdated. You know, and that's like our contemporary challenge. Our contemporary challenge would be to do.
Yeah, I was going to say our contemporary challenges are of a different nature. But my last question really is, what are your thoughts as a traditionally trained scholar on the intellectual history of Ibn Sina in the academic world?
So I'm quite critical of it, because I think that what we call the academic world, it comes from a particular view of religion and humanity. The prevailing view is that, I guess the modern, if you put postmodernism aside, like modernism is the idea that there are these ancient Greeks, pagan philosophers, Aristotle, Plato, Socrates, like you mentioned, who used their mind and did these wonderful things. And then Christianity came along and you fell into the Dark Ages. They closed Aristotle's school of philosophy. But luckily they were the Muslims, right? The Muslims, they were there to catch the learning of the Greeks. And their only role is to catch it and transmit it back to the West.
Yeah, this is the traditional Western narrative, yes.
Yeah.
It's a technical thing of just translating a bunch of texts. That's all.
Yeah. Yeah. And so that there could be a Renaissance and an Enlightenment, and we could rediscover in the Age of Reason. And so the great works of the Greeks. And so in this way of looking at things, you have reason, and then you have religion, which is irrational or at best, you know, irrational. And it's faith based. And so now when I look at intellectual history of Ibn Sina from this perspective, Ibn Sina is going to be somebody who's using his mind, and there are these religious people who don't really use their mind, but he's using Greek learning to give it a rational foundation. But that's not how I think a traditional scholar like Ghazali would have looked at things. Ghazali would have seen the narrative of human history like this. He would say that the first man was the Prophet Adam, who was a believer, and he used his mind and he was rational. God taught him the names of all things. He had vast knowledge, more knowledge than anybody alive today. And he taught people that he was God's messenger, and he taught them about the existence of God. Over time, his message got lost. And then God renewed it with another prophet. And again, it's based on reason and rationality. And there's this loss and regeneration and loss and regeneration. And so when I would look at the way that I look at it is that there was Jesus, and Jesus is a renewal. of that of prophecy. But then there's a corruption. And so the Catholic Church doesn't represent Jesus, but it's a degeneration. And that's why it's not rational. It's based on persecution. And the general narrative of this perspective is that, you know, when the Prophet, when he called people in Mecca to believe, he used his mind. He said, think about it. Do you follow your ancestors, even though they weren't guided? And they said, no, we don't want to use our minds. We're just going to persecute you and kill you. You know, so so it's the opposition that's irrational. And the rationality is there tied with revelation. So from this perspective, when I look at Ibn Sina, he's in the middle. And if he has Ibn Sina or Aristotle, you know, when they make arguments for the existence of God that are good and that Ghazali and others then take, then I would imagine that they would have gotten it from some kind of a prophetic source, some origins, so, because that's the basis. And God sent messengers to every people. Allah says in the Quran, وَإِن مِّنْ أُمَّةٍ إِلَّا خَلَى فِيهَا نَذِيرٌ. There was not a single people except that there was a messenger, a warner that was sent among them. This includes the Greeks. So when I see the great work of Aristotle, it has an origin. It came from somewhere. It didn't just come out of a vacuum, you know. And I think that this is what's missing. What we need is we need people who are traditionally trained in Islamic sciences, who can do things like Ghazali, and to engage the modern intellectual arena in this manner without imbibing this academic way of things.
But that sounds just like you, doesn't it? Actually, that's what you do.
Yeah.
You just described your job.
this is what moves me.
Thank you for that. I just want to recommend a book. This one, it's called Classical Islamic Theology, A Cambridge Guide to Classic Islam, published by Cambridge University Press. And this is a very unique book in English. There are very few books like this because it's on Islamic theology. That's from the Quran, basically, up to the 18th century. So it doesn't talk about modern contemporary issues, but classical Islamic theology. So the first part looks at the historical perspectives, looks at the Quran Hadith by Professor Abdul Halim. All these individual chapters, by the way, are written by world-class experts in the field. There's a chapter on early Kalam and falsafa, the Islamic philosophy, and the social construction of orthodoxy, which actually sounded really boring. When I read it, I thought, wow, this is really helpful. And then the second part is called themes. So it looks at God, his essence and attributes. And then another chapter on creation, another chapter on ethics, one on revelation, cosmology and the existence of God, one on worship. It's interesting, a whole chapter on worship in a book on classical Islamic theology. Another one in theology and jurisprudence, theology and mysticism, epistemology and divine discourse. And the last chapter, very appropriately, is called eschatology, which is to do with the last things. So this is a feast for the intellect, if you're into these things, and I certainly am. It's actually very readable, very diverse readership. Is edited by our own, say, our English Tim Winter, Sheikh Abdul Hakim Murad, who had the immense privilege of meeting on Friday at the Cambridge Muslim College. And he's a support. He has been described by some people, I think, without hyperbole, as the modern Al Ghazali, and that is a compliment. A surpassing compliment. So anyway, he edited this and he actually wrote the introduction to this book. So if you want a really excellent introduction to classical Islamic theology in an academic way, but it's still introductory work for the general public, I do recommend this. And I think it's pretty unique in English as a standard introduction. So that would be my recommendation. And that was one of the reasons why I contacted Sheikh Hamza Karamali. He was actually reading through this and I got up to page 211, Ibn Sina, argument from contingency. That's Ibn Sina and I thought, that's interesting. And so I contacted you and you said, why don't we do what we just done this session? So that was the background stimulus for our meeting today. So I'm immensely grateful to Sheikh Hamza Karamali for your time, your expertise. I'm sure this program will be your benefit for understanding. Ibn Sina is immensely influential. It's difficult to overstate his influence historically on the West, let alone on the Islamic world. And I think if we want to have an education and be able to have an awareness of the Islamic tradition, then we've got to at least understand who he was, when he lived, and what his influence was on traditional Islamic theology and on other matters too. You mentioned medicine and a whole bunch of other things. So he's a polymath, as I say. So thank you very much, Sheikh, for your time.
Thank you for having me. It's always a
pleasure. Until next time.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.